Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. Like a lot of people, I have a lot of creative interests, most of which I don't have time to pursue, something that as one ages, one becomes increasingly aware of, at least in my experience. And in one of those, I always imagine that there are parallel worlds where I'm able to completely indulge in all of the things that I'm interested in. And because I am not a sleepless robot of creative expression, I'm an ordinary human being. I don't get to do so many of them. And one of the one of those parallel worlds, I'm an artist and I draw and I do it all the time. And in this world, about the only time I let myself spend time drawing is when I'm traveling. I'll bring a notebook and I take notes and I write my journal entries. And I found it's a wonderful way to travel because I'm usually with somebody else, and you know, you're always moving around. You want to see something new. You want to get on what's up, what's around the next corner. And drawing not only allows me to settle down and actually look at something and spend some time with something, allowing it its depths to be revealed, but it also interrupts the kind of hastiness of tourist consciousness. In other words, drawing is not only something to do as a part of creative expression, but also something that one does with one's mind and to some extent one's spirit. And so I've been trying to bring some more drawing back into my life and not having it just be when I travel. And one great help here is a new book by John F. Simon Jr., who is a new media artist who lives in New York City. And he's done a lot of work, early work, with using computers and algorithms to explore what art means in a digital age. And he's been, you know, exhibited internationally. He's a real artist. He's got degrees. He's got awards. He's got lots of shows. But though, while he mostly works or is best known for his work with LCD screens and software approaches to art, his book is really just about a much simpler practice of daily drawing. And it kind of falls in line with you know, really well-known books like The Artist's Way and Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain, practices where or books where the drawing and the exploration of art and the, you know, encouragement to find your own way into art and learn some tricks is paired with the idea that drawing is part of a path, of a larger path, a contemplative path, a spiritual path, a way of being in the world, a way of relating to the world. And so I'm very convinced, having gone through John's book, more reading it than putting it into practice, unfortunately, because the aforementioned discussion of not letting myself draw as much as I'd like. It's a wonderful approach, and as a spiritual practitioner as well as someone interested in art, I'd say it gets a big thumbs up on both counts. So I'm very happy that John agreed to come on the show today and talk about his book, Drawing Your Own Path, 33 Practices at the Crossroads of Art and Meditation. So, John, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Eric. Thank you, Eric. It's a great pleasure to be here. Great honor.
Yeah, well, I just like to start off with, you know, I'd like to find out a little bit more about what your sort of official art is about and has been about, because, of course, I'm also interested in issues of computers and digital expression and whatever. I want to get to drawing your own path, but I think it might be interesting to start off talking a little bit about your own work with computers and algorithms and software as an approach to both conceptual problems and expressive possibilities in art.
Sure, that'd be great. Yeah, it goes way back into the 1980s when I was an undergraduate and then a graduate doing earth and planetary science. And at that time, the only people who were working with digital images were NASA, who were sending satellites out into space. And I was doing photography, but I was also interested in science. And I found this group who were using computers to process photographs. So it seemed to merge there, and how exciting it was. Now, of course, with Photoshop, the things happen instantly. But in those days, to process photographs, you had to actually write computer programs. And so that's how I learned in the very beginning, because I was so interested in the ways that pixels could be manipulated and changed around. And that followed with art schools, especially the School of Visual Arts in New York, where I went a few years later to get a MFA. And the Macintosh computer and all the personal computers that came out, all of a sudden it was possible for art schools to have computers. And in the beginning, the founding principle of the computer art MFA department was to figure out what computers and art had to do with each other, which seems so obvious now. But in those days, no one could imagine that a computer could be creative or do creative things or enable creativity.
Well, at that time, what was it that what were your feelings? Did you have an intuition that this could be incredibly powerful, or was it almost more like exploring an alien world of rational numbers and technical processes and algorithms to just sort of even just to explore it and see like what's going on with this world?
Yeah, the exploration was a big part of it, because I was taking before that I was taking Viking orbiter images of Mars and. Literally, we were exploring Mars, and we were trying to map sections of Mars with digital images. That was one of the first digital cameras that was sent out into space. People don't maybe realize the Apollo program was all done with Hasselblads and film cameras and darkroom processes. But the Viking orbiter went out into the world, and so, I saw the possibilities. There were tremendous possibilities, and there were the possibilities to explore. And at the same time, we saw Richard Voss and Benoit Mandelbrot come out with fractals and these huge landscapes. And then it seemed to me there was an inner world going on inside the computer that was equally deep as the universe outside, where we were sending cameras to look at sort of fractal landscapes and all sorts of computed landscapes inside the computer. And so there was this micro and macro world, and they were both digital. They were all in the same media, and they could be mixed. So that was really an incredibly exciting time.
And did you go, were you inspired by the example of the Mandelbrot set and fractals to explore kind of mathematics and the ways in which algorithms could be, the complexity of algorithms could be exploited in order to produce patterns and relationships that you might not be able to see, just using human media, human artistic media?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, what could be revealed, I think. And also I wanted to understand what could be done as a creative partnership. So I began writing drawing tools, which would, for instance, make a fractal line along as you move the mouse along. So you would get the revealing generation of the fractal line, but you also had your hand motion on top of that. So all of a sudden, these things got sort of combined. So there was discovery, mathematical discovery to be made. There was abstraction or changing of the world outside with digital cameras and then processing. And then there was the hand motion that could be put on top of that, the artistic gesture that could be put on top of that. So believe me, in the beginning, there was and still no end to the ways you can go and start to combine these things.
As I say, we'll be getting to your own personal drawing practice and the relationships to meditation and contemplative practice overall. But part of the reason you ended up developing your drawing practice, it had to do with your own attempt and to some degree, I don't want to say frustration, but your realization about the limits and the possibilities of getting software to make art. So what were your experiments with software? What were you trying to do? How far were you trying to go? And then what did you end up sort of discovering through that process?
Sure. I started by looking at people like Harold Cohen, who wrote a program called Aaron, which was an artificial intelligence that tried to make drawings. And I spoke to him about it. And algorithmically, it was basically a series of if-then statements and choices. So there wasn't a lot of feedback in the system. There wasn't a lot of what you would call intelligence in the system. And the drawings tended to look like his drawings, which was his goal. So I started there, and I started to do experiments to take art history examples like Mondrian's Broadway Boogie Woogie and activating the traffic in that, and then taking Bauhaus color theory from Johannes Itten and Joseph Albers and doing those color experiments over time. So I was making artworks that were, for instance, color studies that would never repeat themselves. There's so many possibilities in the algorithms that the color studies would continue to evolve. And these were very interesting as paintings, to make a painting that was executing a set of rules for color and always being a different palette showing. And they got very good play. But I wanted to have the software break out of that. I wanted to continue to have the software become more and more aware of its own creative ability and to work outside the set of rules. And that became the kind of the goal. Could I make a algorithm that could exceed its own rules, which is an interesting kind of approach. And I started to look at genetic algorithms and artificial life and emergent systems and self-organizing systems, which is sort of currently in, say, around the mid-90s, the way that those problems were being approached. And then I started to write in the early 2000s a number of pieces of software that would explore what those changes would look like. So an artificial life system that would two drawings would crossbreed and a new drawing would come about. And what I started to learn from that was that the system really could not exceed the rules that made it, and the system always reflected the rules of the creator of the system. And so I became very frustrated with that in a certain way, because the author can't escape his own writing, you know. And if software is a kind of writing, it's the same. So even if the system has more variations than you'll ever see, it'll still be bounded in some way by the rules you make. So even if you allow it to do drawing all vertical and horizontal line drawings, that'll be the rule that's encoded in the system. So I saw not a lot of good ways to totally break out or to have the system do something outside the rules. And that's when I turned inward and I started to ask myself, because I thought that I worked that way, could I self-observe? So at the same time that I was developing all the algorithms, I started a process of drawing and self-observing and saying, could I then discern the rules that I use because I think I'm doing that? And could I identify those rules and then encode them? So it started as a project to sort of make an expert system of creativity so that I could have an artificial intelligence that hopefully would itself be, you know, its own artist.
And what were your what programming environment were you working in?
Well, I started with Symantec C, and then C++, and then MetroWorks Code Warrior, and then I used Apple's Xcode, and I was using OpenGL as a graphics library up at the end.
Wow. And then when you sort of turned to look at your own drawing process sort of under the through the lens of the kind of programming work that you've been doing, the assumption is that your own artistic practice, your own drawing, a freehand drawing, an intuitive drawing, whatever, is also following rules, and that you want to kind of see if you can figure out what those rules are and if you can exceed them. And it was those processes that kind of led to a lot of the practices that you're talking about in drawing your own path.
Yeah, that was it. So my sort of rational, analytical mind needed to justify the drawing in some way after it got started. And so I saw myself as going to work, sitting down and just improvising and just watching myself improvise. Well, it turned out that's a kind of insight meditation going on. I'm watching for the source of where those ideas are coming from. So I'm turning it back to myself. So in some ways, unwittingly, but in other ways, just sitting down for a few minutes a day and improvising and just changing your attention and changing your mindset to allow yourself to do anything creative, even for a short time, is a very liberating experience. You know, you leave the checking of the email and you leave the infinite list of things to do for a second, and you just sort of see what comes up, and it's a kind of an open space. And so I was getting the benefit of that kind of stress reduction and discovery and enjoyment that can come from just freely drawing. And unconsciously, probably, I was really feeding on that. But I still had to justify the time I was spending to myself, of course, because my, business mind wanted to say, how could you spend an hour drawing today? So it was research. So, but over time, I began to dawn on me that that itself was something very interesting going on.
So in a way, the more contemplative side of it, the more spiritual side, if you will, was almost a kind of unexpected outcome of a practice that was more specifically devoted to seeing how your artistic ideas could work themselves and ideas about software and algorithms could work themselves out with freehand drawing.
Yeah, I think the distance it went was completely unexpected. It was almost accidental that I just happened to ask the right question to say, what's the source of this? Why do I feel like I want to do something creative every day? What's the source of this energy that wants to come out and express itself? Thinking that I would capture it for digital purposes or computed purposes, I was going to be very rich making a piece of software that could be creative and make all sorts of images on its own. But then it turns out that's the sort of engine that, you know, we are. Our nature is to discover and to create.
Oh, that's remarkable just hearing you talk about it, because it's so reflective of my own experiences with the kind of the art practices or creative practices I have that aren't my job. You know, my job is words and writing and teaching and talking and doing podcasts. But my, you know, free play is music and to a certain extent art. But it's funny because I also have to have like some rational justification to do it. It's so hard to just do it. The only thing that I can just do actually that way is meditation. And when I was younger, I think I did meditation because I thought it was going to go somewhere. And now I just do it because it's just something I do. And it's funny that I'm able to do that with just the contemplative work. I think partly because once you're sitting, there's not that much to do except to do something very repetitive over and over again. I'm not actually expressing, but as soon as I pick up a pen or a guitar and I doodle or I try to just express, the critic comes in and goes, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So,
that's it.
You know, speaking from a personal point of view, you know, I mean, I want to get back to the story that we have we're talking about algorithms and creativity and contemplative practice. But just, you know, in terms of people using your book and beginning to develop this process where you give yourself some time every day to improvise with drawing, with just letting something happen and use that as a practice, both artistic and or creative and contemplative, it seems like the biggest thing that stands in the way is the critic. Like in my experience, the critic isn't even, it's not even, I can't even get to the page, because the whole question of like what pens I should use or what paper, I'm like already like, I don't know, I'm an idiot. I can't do this. You know, I can't even get to the page, and let alone, you know, start to explore, you know, things like color, which terrify me. I've only ever done black and white drawing. So
You're summing it up very well there. And I think
give me some tools here, John.
You have the tools, but maybe you haven't put them together, because it's the muscle of mindfulness in that moment that's what you need, you know, and just see that in that moment. That's enough before you get to the page. That's even enough of the practice, just to see that contraction that happens around that. And what is that? What's coming up? That's a simple meditation. Is what's coming up for you? Where's the fear? What's the fear that's coming up? What's the doubt? What's the social critique that's happening? Yeah, you point to the inner critic, and that's what we end up discussing a lot with people who work with the book. There's an idea that art is something outside of ourselves that's judged, and it's built up in social convention and in the world with artist celebrities and big albums and all these expectations. Those things we have to just sort of see as different than the creative process. So I separate, you know, art and being creative in that way. And it just, the idea is just to sit back and move along an orthogonal axis to that practice. That's where mindfulness takes you. It takes you a little bit outside, and just to be able to watch and say, okay, I see that I'm nervous, so let me put that aside and just grab a pencil and make two marks. You know, and that's what I say in the beginning. Just grab the paper by the phone and the pen and just scribble a little. And try to go back to that when you were in kindergarten, when you were a kid, you know, and it was just fun to draw. You're going to take the paper, you're going to throw it away when you're done, and no one's going to see it. It doesn't matter. And just see what that feels like. Use the mindfulness to see what that change is like. That's the very beginning.
That's a wonderful use of mindfulness. You know, it's funny. One of the things I like about your book so much is that I'm really interested in how people get to what we could call spirituality, which is kind of a crappy word, but whatever, it's one we got to deal with.
No, I get that.
and how people get there sometimes through very orthogonal routes.
Exactly.
You know, they're not pursuing enlightenment. They're not trying to be the cool yogi. They're just doing something else. And then they stumble into something that actually begins to resonate with, in some ways, the deeper aspects of a lot of these practices. How did that happen in your experience? So you're working with the daily drawing, you're thinking about algorithms, you're thinking about how to develop software, something's happening with this improvisation that seems to be opening up these deeper dimensions. Were you also studying meditation? Did that grow out of that? How did it become more explicitly about contemplative or spiritual practice?
Right. Yeah. So it was opening from I started the daily practice as a discipline thing in about 99. And it began opening more and more through early 2000s up to about 2006. And I thought that I was do you remember the show Heroes? Did you ever see that show on TV?
Yes.
And do you remember the character Isaac Mendez? He was the painter, and his eyes would roll back, and he would paint, and it would be the future, something like that.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and I'd read a lot of Philip K. Dick, of course, and so somehow I thought that being open like this, I was getting this transmission, you know, either from Valis or the future, wherever. And so I was having these kind of ideas that I knew something was going on. I couldn't explain it, and I wasn't well-versed in meditation or anything spiritual at that time, although I read widely, so I knew what it was, but I didn't know that that was happening. So I was shocked, and I was by 2006, I was very confused about what was going on because I was having these experiences. So I started to read widely into Western occult tradition, and I spent a lot of time reading about tarot and the fortune telling and the divination. And of course, Philip K. Dick's Divine Invasion is a book where he discusses manipulating time and the future. And I was making these drawings, which were about, I thought were about the phylogons of Philip K. Dick and seeing the frames of the future. And I started to make my rational stories and tell stories about that. And
can you just describe a little bit more what your experiences were? What became enigmatic or uncanny about the practice that you had, you know, that you had started in 99?
Yeah, I did a series of drawings, which were patterns. At that time early, like 99, 2000, were patterns, very tight patterns. And sometime later in that year, those patterns started to separate. The tiles of the patterns started to separate until the patterns were sort of dissolving and almost blowing apart. And then I was living in New York City in September 2001, September 11th. And that was, of course, a very significant day. And after that, I noticed that a whole new style of drawing came out, whether it was the drama of the day or whether they're really, you know, that began me thinking, got me thinking, is there something prescient in what's being represented? Am I capturing somehow this global zeitgeist? This was all inner talk and story that I was telling. And there was another one where I was drawing what looked like cellular forms and biological forms, and I was justifying it, saying I was interested in Kandinsky's period from the 40s when he was doing biological forms, and I was modeling artificial life systems. And then my wife and I got pregnant with our son. So I was, what are these connections? Am I influencing this? Am I being influenced by it? There's some feedback in the two. And that just kept getting more and more broad, and I kept trying to discern whether I was finding out about my life with these drawings or whether I was finding out about the world. So see, it was very confused, and so I was reading very broadly about these things and still making up these stories.
So what was the first stuff that you read or began to think about that began to make sense? Like, how did you start to frame it in a way that became, clarifying as well as enigmatic?
Right. Well, I had an experience in 2009, where I had this story about called the phylogons, which are written about in the Divine Invasion, and they were in this kind of circular form, and I was talking about them as my daily experience, the planes of experience, and how one experience was dependent on the next, and I had a good story about that. And then one night it occurred to me that the whole reason that I was drawing all these circular forms was really the shape in the middle that wasn't there. And the next day I drew the form, and that shape was a like a profile of a human head. And I had a sort of a no-self experience after that, and I saw that that our whole self was composed of the things we surround ourselves by. So I had kind of a deep experience, and then I had to read more deeply, and I found through podcasts and Buddhist Geeks podcasts, which I was listening a lot to, the Theravada Buddhist Progress of Insight Path, which is they're the sort of the geekiest of the Buddhists that I found, and they sort of have a very well mapped out path. And I found that Progress of Insight Path mapped very well to the creative path. And so that's where it sort of latched on. And that experience is described in there, in that path. Yeah. So I was talking to Buddhist teachers about the experience, and they're saying, that sounds like a no self experience, and showed me where I could read more about it. And I found that was a very well mapped out path. And in the book, in the end of chapter 6, I used the Zen ox drawings, because that's a visual mapping of the more or less the same path to enlightenment that's been used for centuries. And I talk about how that more broadly, generally defined spiritual path can be more specifically pointed to as a part of the creative process, where you have an idea, you're curious, you know, and then you grab the bull and you tame the bull, more or less. You start working, and then you tame the materials, and you master the materials, and then you master the process of drawing. So from that time in 2009 and that no self experience, I got more serious about getting a teacher and figuring it out. And that led me through to some of these, I call them technologies. I mean, I went from computers to meditation, but I say I got more interested in programming the mind than in programming the machine, because these are centuries old technologies that are about manipulating the inner consciousness.
Yes, I mean, one of it's interesting, because you can think about the techniques as being technologies, you know, return the mind to the breath, or observe the observer, or try to turn the lamp back and recognize the source of awareness rather than the object that you're aware of. And these are these kind of techniques, but there's something also additionally interesting about improvisation from that perspective. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is that there's, you know, we have like conventional, maybe romantic ideas of improvisation. Oh, the spirit is moving through me. I'm you know, inspired by something greater than me, and I'm expressing it. And yeah, that can sometimes reflect what it feels like to be improvising. But there's also a kind of more, I don't know what to say. It's like there's a kind of technical way of approaching improvisation that maybe is a less romantic way of understanding it. And since it's such an important part of your practice, I mean, since the daily drawing is, in a way, an experience of improvisation, how have you come to think about improvisation, you know, either from a creative point of view or really from a spiritual point of view? In fact, in some ways, the spiritual question is more interesting. It's, we have an idea of what improvisation means creatively. I'm jamming on my guitar. I'm doodling. I'm, you know, just, finding my way through a set of colors. But spiritually, we don't necessarily think about what improvisation is. So in that sense, the creative path that involves improvisation, intuition, is also telling us something about spirituality.
Yeah, yeah. And it's great that you point that out, because improvisation is so important. There are a couple of things to say about it. One is meditation. After I realized that this spiritual path was important to what I was doing, I began to practice just sitting meditation fairly regularly. And I was averse to it at first, but the teachers I had said that I should really pursue it. And they gave me this breath awareness meditation where I just sit. And of course, we breathe all day without trying. We don't even think about it. So if I sit in a chair and I just breathe and I just sit and observe that, my chest goes up and down. But if I put my attention on it, you know, then I sort of hyperventilate. I get too attuned to it. So the practice is just to be able to sit and just allow it to arise, just allow your breath to arise. And that turned out to be really good cross training for improvisation, especially improvisational drawing, because the practice of just allowing the body to do what it does is really useful. When I was when I was allowing my hand to move and not have that involvement of the critic, but really try not to have any involvement of thought at all. And so in that way, that practice helped. And what I began to see and you're saying in the spiritual side was that I didn't, of course, maybe I'm channeling some higher spirit, or maybe I'm in the moment, or maybe I have a story about how I'm drawing, but maybe I began to see it could all be happening simultaneously and there could be some resonance. And so what was being reflected in the drawing was some of all of those threads, all of those levels of awareness that could be coming through at one time.
Yeah, it's funny. I think it's easier for us, maybe at least from my perspective, to think about this in terms of music. You know, as a music fan and as someone who's played, you know, for decades on and off, but off generally improvising. It was always something that I just did kind of on my own. It wasn't I did very little public performance and mostly played by myself. And we think about whatever Coltrane or something. You write about Coltrane right. A little bit in your book. But we don't think it's harder to think about for some reason, at least for me, with drawing. I mean, we think of maybe doodling. In fact, we use that word doodling for someone who's just noodling or doodling on a guitar. But there's something much more profound going on there. Talk about that. I don't know whether you want to talk about it in terms of art history or your own experience, but where improvisation in art, you know, drawing or artwork is really focused.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. You're really at the heart of it here. So that's great. Yes, as far as doodling goes, I always say, what's the difference between a person sitting in a chair and a person sitting in a chair meditating? You know, it all looks the same. It's really what's happening in their mind. And so I say, the difference between doodling and contemplative drawing is that there's a component of mindfulness in the contemplative drawing. Doodling is just doodling. It's just moving the hand. And the contemplative drawing is watching that, watching what comes up, what comes back in that. And so the heart of the improvisation is this kind of feedback loop and how you're handling what's going on. Are you listening to what you're playing when you're in music? Are you reacting to that? Are you listening to the sounds around you? And there's a great history of improvisational work. If you go back, you can go way back. I mean, at first I thought I had invented this sort of meditative form, of course, because I had come across it in such a weird path. But now that I'm doing more research and my work now is really looking back at more historically where these techniques have applied. But the Surrealists, for instance, did automatic drawing and automatic writing. And they were opening up and improvising the words as they went out and then trying to find meaning. I mean, it's the same way that I asked whether a computer program could break out of its own rules. How do you break out of your own language rules? How do you break out of your own habits? Sometimes you have to do things that are out of the ordinary and you have to move in ways that are out of the ordinary. And that's what John Coltrane would talk about when he tried different chords and combinations of notes, or he'd play notes simultaneously, is to break out of those ordinary patterns. And so, in drawing, improvising is not sometimes not listening to what you think it should be, but just moving as, I don't know what, on a feeling, on the temperature of the room, on an emotion that arises. And so that element of mindfulness helps you see what comes up. On one hand, to move the critic and to move thoughts out of the way to allow the hand to go, but also to sort of get a groove with it and see what you respond to. So in the beginning, when I would make marks, I would always go with the joyous thing. I would say, oh, that looks good, you know, and I move myself in ways that were entertaining. And then also being mindful of what was going on and looking for variation, looking for novelty in the process. I would move my hand in a way that I couldn't anticipate the mark. And that's what I loved about the computer drawing tools, was that I was using an activated line on the screen, say a fractal line or a spinning line, and I would move my hand and I couldn't anticipate what the mark would be. And so it was always discovery at the same time that it was what I was making. And I think that's good improvisation, that you're moving in a way and you're skilled enough in a way through practice to get things that aesthetically work, but at the same time it's discovery and that makes it exciting. And so every day I sit down to draw and I don't know what is going to be on the card. I don't know what's going to come up, which is an exciting thing. And then I improvise and I move in different directions and I look for novelty. And then I read the drawing later and I think, wow, how did I get to that? And lots of times there'll be a reading, like when you get in astrology, when someone gives you a reading and you can relate it to yourself, when you look at your drawing, imprinted in there are many things like that you remember when you were later that were going on in your mind when you were drawing, like, oh, I remember I was frustrated at that point. Oh, I remember it was flowing at that point, or deeper memories, music that you heard when you were drawing it, that kind of thing. So lots of stuff gets encoded into the improvisation, into the line, and it can't be any other way. It can't be anything but a reflection of that whole stacked, resonant state of being that you are when you make it. And the degree to which you're mindful of and in touch with that, you'll read back in the drawing. And all those things together are what's happening in the improvisation.
Yeah, that's just wonderful. And I love the way that you include, and there's a whole chapter in your book about reading the drawings. It's not just about getting to a place where you can improvise daily and just express and not worry about the traces that you're leaving, for the past or for the future. Nice. You're just doing it in the moment. But to then say, okay, yeah, but unlike, when I do a meditation, there's no record. I could go all over the place. I kind of improvise in my meditation, but there's no record. So I can't really, like, the next day, it's just the residue of the ash of the incense that I burned. But here you can go through as rich a process, and yet there you have this record that allows you to kind of reconstruct where you were at.
I love that about it. I absolutely love that about it. And I also ask people to draw on slips of paper or on cards as opposed to in a book, because one of the practices to spread all the drawings out on a table, you see, over the 30 days or whatever you've done, maybe it may be a corner of a grocery store receipt that you made three marks on 2 weeks ago, and then the next day you were more formal, and the next day was on a bag. You see, you can remember how you struggled at those times, or you pushed yourself, or how you used discipline, and you read that back, and you can see that trace in the drawings. And then what happens for me now is that I begin to see symbols that are persistent over a period of time, and I feel like those are important, more important to read. And I tell stories about them, but they also become some of the larger artworks that I make now.
That's great. Since, we've sort of been talking about your daily practice and the kinds of practices that you introduce people, we should probably talk a little bit, because I'm sure people are listening to this going like, I want to do this. when you do workshops, what's sort of the first suggestions you make for people who want to pursue this kind of combined contemplative drawing practice?
Yeah, grab a slip of paper, whatever, and start making marks. I say, take the pencil and first of all, just feel the pencil in your hand. If you have time to work on it, like, begin to engage the senses, because there's very good evidence that shows that if we engage two or more of our senses, the selfing, the inner voice process quiets down. You know how you get into running and you're hearing and feeling the run and your mind goes, or you're playing an instrument and your hands are involved and your ears are involved and all of a sudden you get quiet. The same happens in drawing. When you feel the pencil and you're paying attention to the sound of it and what it looks like and what it feels like, you can notice the selfing process quiets down and you just become, your attention becomes focused on what's coming out. And so I start people, just raising your attention a little bit and just doing it. You have to, it's like you could read the book. It'd be like reading a cookbook. If you don't go in the kitchen, you'll never know what the food tastes like that's being described. So you have to pick up the pencil interleaved in the book on the blue pages in the book are all exercises, and they're simple, but they're meant for to be done, because you won't really get what I'm talking about unless you do the practice and pay attention to what's going on when you do it. And like you said, the first thing is that critic, that may be before you even get to it. So I try to work with that in the beginning and say, just be a kid. Remember kindergarten and just had crayons and just was just fun and it was for nothing and you had no expectations. Try to recapture that moment and just let loose and just draw. And then just, if you're embarrassed or you're worried or whatever, do it where no one can see it and just throw it away. But probably you won't. You probably want to keep it and then see what grows, and the exercises go from there. And then I also have systematic drawing is the second chapter, which is also for people that are not just still not comfortable improvising or still not comfortable making marks. We draw lines between points, and there's one called the circle arrow, which is like the enso. So it's like a mantra practice. So instead of having to draw anything, I tell you exactly what to draw. Draw a circle, and when you're about to connect the circle, draw a little arrowhead, and that's like a self-reflection, and that brings your mind back to the beginning. And you just draw this circle arrow over and over like a mantra, and then you're drawing. And so you start to get the physical, visual engagement that gets that quieting down, which I think is what happens in mantra practice when you get into the vibration and the repeating sound and quiet down. So lots of places to get into it. And then I give three chapters, realistic drawing for people that want to do more like concentration meditation, where you look at something, you know, very carefully, and you get this kind of access concentration when you finally see the coffee cup or the bell or whatever it is you're drawing, not as a thing, but as this combination of patterns and lines. So that's one way in. The systematic drawing is more mantra-like, and the improvisational drawing is kind of like an open awareness. And all three of them are fine. And I just present a lot of practices in the beginning that people can try, hopefully that they'll find one that they just like to do and love to do and will repeat it for a while. That's my experience in workshops. And I have an online group, and we meet for drawing online through that Google Hangouts and such, and draw together. And the experience is that people just start enjoying doing it, and then we work from there with the things to try and ways to go and what's happening.
Yeah, I mean, from a meditator perspective, I think that the point at which I realized that you were really onto something, now that, I mean, I got it, it seemed cool, like, already, was that the way in which that basic distinction within meditation between, on the one hand, concentration practice, where you're returning to a single object, usually often the breath, and whatever else is going on, you just keep bringing it back, and then that becomes a portal to a set of experiences and ways of being, versus this more open awareness where it's simply what is arising, including thoughts, including sounds or feelings in your body, and you acknowledge them and let them go and move on to an open space where something else happens. Those are very different things. I mean, from the inside, from a meditator's point of view, they're quite noticeable when you're in one mode or another. And they're so perfectly reflected in these drawing practices, in the way in which drawing, looking intimately at an object and trying to copy it or express it, requires this focus that's very different than in the improvisatory zone. I'm curious what other things that you were doing for artistic reasons or for drawing reasons ended up having an impact on the way you experience meditation and contemplative work, how it kind of fed back that way, if you will.
Yeah. There were many. Once the cycle drawings led to that no self experience, that's when I thought it was real. Something real was going on. And then it was several years of working that way. And there'll be periods where I'm improvising and I don't have any persistent image dominating. But a couple of years after the cycle drawing, I started to get this image of the frame opening up. And I just was reading over today, looking back over today, some of the notes I had from Philip K. Dick, because I know you were involved in his editing the exegesis, and I was reading all that at the time. This was about 2011, 2012 when it came out, and reading deeply about in framing and how the story we tell frames us, and all of my drawings were these kind of square frames, and I've done some larger work with these square frames. And then all of a sudden the frame started to open and the contents of the frame started to expand and move outside that frame. And now I call it the expansion series, and it's sort of still going on. The show I have up in 63rd Street at Sandra Gehring in Manhattan is all expansion works. They're drawings and sculptural works that have to do with this expansion. And it more or less had to do with what I would say you'd call it like spiritual growth. I put my emphasis on spiritual artistic growth at the time, and the feedback of the drawing practice and the meditation practice started to really take off, and the writing around it started to take off. And so there's just a whole series of works, which you can also see on my website, numeral.com,
that's the professional work, where there's what look like picture frames, moldings, gold moldings of picture frames on the left, and there's a little point in it, a tiny little point in the beginning, and it grows and grows and grows until it exceeds the bounds of the frame. And so this was somehow metaphorical, I sort of found out later, for me, beginning to see the process in itself. And the culmination of that was a year or so ago when I gave a talk about the meditation and the drawing practice, and it led to a contract for the book, and then I ended up writing the book. So that was me moving from the frame of reference of calling myself an artist outside into some more larger chaotic mixture of a world.
It's wonderful how the formal aspect and the inner aspect are looped together, especially with this issue of framing. When people go to numeral.com or just do a Google search on your name, you'll find some of these images, and they really have a very interesting kind of trippy quality to them, because that whole notion of the frame is so basic, especially when you start doing consciousness work, where you're part of the work involves like recognizing how the way you were just thinking or the way you were just experiencing was something that was kind of enframed. And once you become aware of the framework, there's a slippage, a gap, a crack, something opens up, other possibilities emerge, and you can kind of play with that distinction. I'm curious, I know you read the exegesis it's pretty seriously, like a lot of people get that thing and they think they're going to do it, and then they go, oh my God, this is insane, I can't deal with it. But you spent some time with there. What did you make of it in the end? Was it helpful for you, like in terms of, not just talking about Philip K. Dick and what he thought and what his visions were like? I mean, that could be a whole other conversation. But really, for you as someone who was seeking, looking, wanting to be informed, wanting to have inspiration, was it helpful for you in a certain way?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was. It's a tremendous book. I make some. I equate it a certain way to another book that came out at around the same time, which was the Red Book of Carl Jung. They published, and that was an inner exegesis of Carl Jung and his exploration at a sort of a similar. He had a sort of a similar crisis moment, when he wrote that, in a couple of years after he had that, and I think Philip K. Dick the same. If you just want to see that inner improvisation of what this is and how we can try to put this into words, there are really amazing examples. And Philip K. Dick was a good writer that way, and he could express things very well. And he wasn't afraid to use the memes of science fiction to get to concepts that are hard to get to otherwise. And it allowed him to go outside of the ordinary writing. So I found it enlightening, and it gave me models that I didn't have before. Especially the Phylagon model was a really important model to talk about the frames and how the frames move. Because in the book, one of the characters moves the frames backward and forward, and moves time backward and forward, and goes into a frame, and then you're in the moment. And I thought those were great models to use to think about thinking before I really knew anything about meditation, or knew very much about meditation, and how you could use mindfulness to move outside of and become the observer. That was all described there for me. So those are really good things.
And there were drawings in there, of course. He'd do these little doodles, some of which were models of the systems he was describing, and some of which were more free, especially the fish sign. The ichthys, he would mutate that. He'd draw a fish, and then the fish would become a mouth, and the mouth would get teeth, and then it would become DNA strand. And so he even describes some of his visions as having that kind of artistic, improvisatory, mutant kind of quality. So in some ways, it's quite resonant with the things you're talking about. What I want to come around here, as we wrap up, is how has this made you think about computers again? I mean, you still work with software, you still have an interest in that. It's less, necessarily the focus that it was at one point. But since there's so many questions now, people are, suddenly artificial intelligence is clearly happening. It's going to be out and running, however you define it. Genetic algorithms, learning algorithms. If you just think about Google's own software that creates that sort of psychedelic effect with images by coming up with certain algorithmic ways of modeling how we see things, how has this very organic, very personal, very intimate, very in some ways very interior process of doing daily drawing, of deepening into contemplation, how has that changed the way you look at computers, the way you look at artificial intelligence or the artistic possibilities of computers?
Yeah, I used to think about computers much more separate from me as the computer, and that I push the button and it would do something. And I see it really, technology as becoming so ubiquitous and so integrated at some point as to not be really distinguishable, or from our own selves and our own bodies, depending on how we end up making computers and integrating them into ourselves. I mean, how does the clam regard the mechanism of its body that makes the hard shell? You know, does it think of it as part of it, or does it think of it as a machine that builds its house or something like that? So I think we'd have these technologies, and nowadays especially the networking and communication capability is reforming these kinds of neural nodes of computers and humans that are doing certain kinds of thinking, specialized kind of thinking, that were really impossible to imagine when I began, that you would find a group of people who are interested in contemplative practice and creative practice that could practice together. Being, I'm in New York, someone's in Portland, someone's in Florida, all, you know, one evening together. So, yeah, I don't think about conquering them the same way or turning them into things the same way as how it's augmenting the reality that I'm living right now.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And another, you know, kind of version of that question gets back to this issue about improvisation. We talked earlier about how when you started this practice, you were thinking, well, just the same way that software has these rule sets, more or less sophisticated if-then statements or feedback loops or whatever, so human beings must have the same thing when they set out to make a drawing, even to do an improvisatory drawing. In other words, the improvisation is inside the framework of some unspoken rules. Do you still feel that way? Do you think that whatever the source of improvisation comes from, does it have that quality? Can it be replicated, let's say, in software? Or do we get to, does something more mysterious happen at a certain point? Is there something more enigmatic about?
This is the tough question, definitely. I'm at the moment, I'm on the side of in the von Neumann architecture computers we have now, it will never be brought down because of many reasons. But one is we have certain needs and computers don't have needs. And we're driven by a lot of that. And so if someone was to encode that, it would be their needs and not general needs. You know what I'm saying? So I think it's broader and more mysterious. And the other thing that happened was that I saw that what I was defining as creative practice and what I was trying to put down in rule sets as creative practice was just a very narrow definition of what creativity is. And that, in fact, how we choose to dress every day, which way we turn, what we say, how we make up our speech, how we move through the world, how we interact, those are all creative things. And the world around us, the trees and the animals, the universe remixing itself, is all creation is happening all the time. And so creativity is a much broader thing, and the source is the thing that's making the work itself. If you think about it, the universe that combined itself to make us is continuing to combine itself to make. So the self gets out of the way there. So the question kind of dissolves.
Yeah, that's very well put. You must be getting some interesting feedback now from other people who have been working with your book and have been working with your workshops, because I know you were doing stuff beforehand. As you bring these techniques and possibilities out to the world, what's been some of the stuff that's really moved you?
My mind's been blown by the way people are responding and the feedback that I get. And it just, that for certain people at certain times, it's just the right practice. And I went to San Antonio and I gave a workshop for a group of university level accounting teachers. So it's not just artists and it's not just contemplatives, but for some people, just this moment of creativity, just this opening is such a revelation. It's such a new thing. It's such an exciting thing. And I didn't really realize that it would have as much impact on people, whether or not they did art or not. And I think that's really what I would like to see for my work in the future and for where the book would go, is just to get in the hands of people who it can help. There was a woman who did the workshop and began drawing every day, and was sending me her drawings, and I was seeing the drawings. It was wonderful work. And then had kind of a crisis in her life. Someone passed away, and the drawing was there for her. She told me, this is her, what she had told me, that being able to just escape into the improvisational drawing and do that work and let out the emotions and let out the feelings was a way that she got through it. So, I mean, my God, that's who could imagine that thinking about computer algorithmic creativity could lead to impact someone's life like that. So that's been quite gratifying, quite interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I suspect that you'll have a great deal of success with this book. You know, I've met a lot of people over the years that have done, you know, like the people who have used the Artist's Way, a very successful, right, very popular way of integrating art and contemplation. We know it's a wonderful book, and it's been around for a while. And there's something fresh and, you know, frankly, more in tune with our digital reality about your approach, even though your actual practice doesn't involve computers. The fact that you come from that angle adds a geeky, whatever you want to call it, dimension that I think is really resonant with people. I mean, I showed my uncle your book over Thanksgiving, and he was just instantly into it. So anyway, that's the sound of the show ending. So John Simon, thanks so much for being with us on Expanding Mind.
Hey, Eric, it's been great. It's been great. People can go to drawingyourownpath.com and find out more.
Great. All right, and until next week, keep your minds open.